Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell. We're here on Monday. It's October 1st, 2018. We have basically one quarter of the NFL season is wrapped up. We're already 25% of the way through the year. And so excited to have an old friend of the show on. Once we referred to her as the professor of the NFL. Now, as the host of Bootleg with Mina Kayyem, she is strictly competition for your ears on the ESPN network. It is Mina Kayyem. Mina, what's up?
I continue to reject the name of the professor. I feel like you have been trying to stir up a beef between me and John Clayton. I am not the professor. I am more of the TA who maybe wants to hang out after class. No professorship here.
I have a very close friend who is a TA at the moment who has office hours and does not ever get anyone to attend their office hours. So I suggested they should have the office hours, which is where they pitch their students to come watch The Office with them in a room.
Mm. Or donuts, maybe?
Or just donuts. Is that your plan to get people to tune in to Bootleg with Mina Kayyem is to just offer random listeners donuts? Is that true?
I will mail you donuts. No, I won't. Did you have, what are those called, like study breaks in college where, you know, like your dorm would say, okay, like midnight while you're working, we're going to order Thai food or pizza or something?
Sure. I mean, like that, did I eat food? I'm confused. Like, yes, of course I ate food at bad times of the night in college. That's just a natural thing.
But the dorms or the RAs and the TAs and stuff would do this for you. I just remember so vividly organizing my entire life around these study breaks. Figuring out when they were in, like, dormitories I didn't even belong to. Sort of showing up very, like,
so some people,
slyly.
Some people try to sneak into parties in other dorms or other fraternities, perhaps. You were sneaking in to get the delicious Thai and pizza of New Haven, Connecticut.
Just like I'm sneaking back on your podcast to promote Bootleg with Mina Kayyem.
Well, should we talk about Bootleg with Mina Kayyem here before we get started?
Sure. So it's called Bootleg just because it's kind of janky. It was a bit of an awkward rollout, but it is on iTunes now. It's on Stitcher and all the same places where you can find most podcasts, ESPN podcasts. And we're starting once a week, hopefully transitioning to twice a week at some point in October. TBD, but for now it's just kind of, you know, talking football. Pretty simple.
Wow. Wish someone had come up with that idea, doing a podcast twice a week where you talk about football on the ESPN network.
No one has ever started a podcast before, too. This is a completely original idea. I should have patented it, but it's too late.
Yeah, you beat Serial to the punch, but sadly. most importantly, Lenny is going to have a role on this show, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing the thing when we started The Morning Rose, which is my radio show, and I was trying to get people to download it. I said if I got 50 reviews, I would feature an interview with Lenny, which is maybe the most shameful thing that I do is have extended conversations with my dog. And I posted one online. I guess I could do that. I don't know if the demand for that is as high as maybe it was back then, but we'll see.
Well, Lenny is still the primary reason I interact with you, as I'm sure Maggie is the primary reason you interact with me. Did you see that our old friend Robert Mays adopted a dog who looks almost exactly like Maggie, my dog?
He kind of looks like, actually I was thinking a mix of Maggie and Lenny a little bit.
That's basically a little suspicious, no?
All of our, so you and I met, I promise guys we'll get to talking about football very soon, but Barnwell and I met through Robert Mays at a live Grantland NFL live show. And I feel like we should restage that. It actually was around this time 3 years ago, maybe, right? September.
4 years ago, I think.
It was my birthday, my 30th birthday. No, 3 years ago. Because I'm 33. Yes. Don't age me. And I feel like we should stage the reunion, but just have our dogs there.
Yes, because all of us have dogs. Mace has a dog, you have a dog, I have a dog, and Josh Gondelman, our friend, the comedian who narrates for Last Week Tonight, also has a very beautiful dog named Busy. So just a dog podcast would be great. Do you think we could actually get 300 people or however much it was to pay $5 to see our dogs on stage?
No.
I disagree with you strongly. I think we could pull it off. And I'm open to it. I'm absolutely open to it. But we're not allowed to do any podcast content, just dogs.
Talk to Lenny's people.
Talk to Lenny's people. Well, let's get to some football stuff here before we start talking about our dogs for a half hour. The good news is we have such wonderful, fun things to talk about. Like, oh, Earl Thomas broke his leg yesterday. We planned this in advance of that. Maybe it would have been a more fun conversation in some ways, but obviously I think we should talk about it. You are someone who, of course, has been a Seahawks fan for many, many years now. And we've talked a bunch, just offline about Earl Thomas and his situation. And I mean, I don't have like some grand thought about this. It just sucks. It's just sad that this happened to a player who clearly did not want to be stuck in the situation he was in, worrying about this possibility happening, and then, well, it happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the worst outcome for... Well, it's not the worst, so I just... Yes. I think Ian Rappaport did share today Earl should be, I think, healthy again by the time of the Super Bowl or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's not going to get as good of a contract or, you know, who knows how it would have shaken out, if it would have been traded or whatever. Obviously, it hurts his financial prospects, but it's not... You know, devastation, right? It's not a career-ending injury or anything, and I want to put that out there first. But for him, for the team, for other teams that wanted Earl Thomas, you know, it's obviously a lose-lose-lose all the way around, and it's kind of one of those things in the NFL where I'm not sure you can really blame anyone. Like, it is kind of a thing where everyone, and again, I'm counting Earl, the Seahawks, and teams that were thinking about trading him, may have acted logically here, right? And that it's just sort of how the NFL shakes out sometimes, where nobody's interests are aligned, and it stinks for everyone. I mean, it certainly, first and foremost, stinks for this defense. Although Bradley McDougal has been good, and people pointed out, you know, there are two safeties on the field, which people seem to have forgotten, and their play is affected by each other. So I expect him to be impacted. His ability to, he's been pretty aggressive, crashing the box and stuff. And that's, you know, that's going to change with Patrick Thompson back there and not Earl Thomas. So just from a football standpoint for this team, it's going to hurt pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, from the Seattle perspective, it's not as if this was a team that, you know, I think could harbor realistic hopes of making a long playoff run. There just is not the talent there up and down the roster. I'm sorry to reveal this
How
to you.
How dare you?
They did win yesterday. They are 2-2, but I mean, just, you know,
I wish they didn't in some level.
Right. Thinking about it from Earl Thomas's perspective, I mean, you know, we saw the reaction. Like, he literally flipped off the, he flipped off the Seattle sideline, and they had to basically just pretend it didn't happen afterwards. Like Pete Carroll, the way he's acted throughout this entire process has been so strange. Like there is sort of a...
Pete or Earl?
Pete.
Okay.
I think Pete's been real, like, Earl has been pretty rational throughout the entire process, especially, you know, given that Earl is someone who I think is obviously really talented and smart, but also is someone who's prone to, like, you know, retiring on Twitter during a game a few years ago. Right. Like, he's a very emotional person, I think, in some ways, but Pete has been sort of like acknowledging that something's wrong, but also like denying that it's a big deal this entire time. And that extended to him basically saying, oh, well, there's a lot of people in the stadium. He could have been flipping off anybody. I mean, it has to be infuriating. I don't know.
Like, I hear you. And, you know, he said, we love him and, you know, and stuff like that. And obviously they didn't love him enough to want to pay him, which, well, within their right. I don't agree with it from a purely football standpoint. I thought that they should extend him. And, you know, you can't, hindsight is 20/20. You can't say just because someone got injured, they shouldn't have extended him based on his talent, based on what he contributed to that defense. That was the outcome I wanted. Okay. I don't know. I just keep looking at this and I really think it's the perfect example of why teams are sometimes reluctant to pay players, but more so why players are well within their rights to use the only leverage that they have, right? Which is a holdout. Now, I don't think it's perfectly analogous to what's happening with Le'Veon Bell, for example, for a number of reasons, but I don't know. I just look at this and I just understand everyone's position in a weird way. And I don't mean to be like kumbaya about it. It is like the NFL has so much lose-lose in it. And I think this is just a perfect example of lose-lose for everyone.
Right. I mean, no side is incentivized to do a thing that is going to help the other side beyond Earl playing you know, kind of playing and sitting out as much as possible while playing in games and getting closer to your free agency. And, well, we saw the impact of that. I mean, you mentioned Le'Veon Bell, and like you said, it is not the same situation. You can't really compare the two in terms of just they're, you know, Le'Veon Bell is actually holding out. So Earl Thomas was not holding out. But at the same time, given the concerns that Le'Veon Bell has expressed publicly and privately, you have to figure he saw this and kind of was just everything I've been worried about and coming back is reinforced by what happened to Earl Thomas here.
Yeah, it's all calculus, right? So Earl Thomas played because he decided he wanted to make the money he earned by playing, which is completely, it's a lot of money, right? And so he decided that the risk of injury that he would incur or, you know, simply not wanting to be there was outweighed by the game checks he would receive. And he's going to get paid through the end of the year now, right? It's like $10 million or something.
Yes.
Right now, Le'Veon Bell is doing that calculus and coming up with the opposite conclusion. He's decided that the injury risk is not worth the whatever, $14 million, you know, prorated over 10 games or whatever. So, you know, I find it so impossible to gauge whether those decisions are right or not. Because you can't, like, quantify the likelihood of getting hurt. I know people try to do it, but so when I look at Le'Veon Bell and I say he's giving up $10 million or whatever, but he's not going to get injured, well, who knows? Like, we don't know. And it's an individual decision, and I don't really think any player is right or wrong in making it.
Right. And the context of that situation is that, you know, Le'Veon Bell did not negotiate this CBA. He wasn't even in the league when the CBA was signed, if I'm not mistaken. It's not as if he can sit there even if he wanted to. I don't think that's going to make a difference if you're a player, but sit there and say, oh, well, this is what I signed up for and I have to deal with it. Like, he inherited this because the players of the previous administration or the previous generation, in 2010, 2011, negotiated a deal that really sold rookies out. And,
yes.
And Le'Veon Bell has been underpaid for several years now. I would argue that the franchise tag is probably about what he deserves. I wouldn't be, you know, it's not as if that's an issue, but he has no clear path to a long-term deal at that rate until he hits free agency. And so, I mean, I don't fault him for what he's doing. And I don't fault his decision making. And I don't fault the Steelers necessarily, for not giving him that deal, right?
It's like all these situations. It's like you can't really blame anyone. I mean, look, you can blame teams when they blatantly do things to screw over players, you know.
Yes.
But I don't think in either situations you can fault team or player, quite honestly. And then obviously with the CBA, I'm glad you said that because I hate when people say, well, he should have negotiated differently. It's like, what? You know, right, when he was a rookie. Obviously, those decisions made in the CBA, which do hurt rookies, talented rookies, first-round picks, they benefit other players. The CBA, it's zero-sum. The NFL is a hard-capped league. So we focus on those contracts because they're the players that are notable and, you know, in a meritocracy, they would get paid more. But there are other players in the NFL who do benefit from those financial decisions made in the contract. So it's hard. There are winners and losers in all these situations, and it's necessarily certain groups are privileged.
Mm-hmm. And that the group who is privileged is strictly Sam Bradford. He's the only person who benefits from.
He didn't get paid this week. Poor Sam Bradford.
Imagine expecting to get $300,000 in a week and not getting it.
And then imagine being Sam Bradford and not caring.
Not caring. And then injuring yourself walking to your car in the driveway. That is the Sam Bradford life. In terms of the Seahawks bigger picture, in terms of how we think about this team, this generation of Seahawks players, and what happened with Pete Carroll and John Schneider over this last 6, 7, 8 year stretch. I mean, do you think what happened on Sunday in terms of like your memories about this era as a fan and also as an analyst, like, are you going to remember more positives about this era than negative things? Because you can point to, okay, I mean, I don't want to mention the Super Bowl, but, you know, the Super Bowl play was bad. That Cardinals game was depressing as hell last year. And of course, I mean, Earl flipping off flipping off the sideline as he leaves, presumably for the last time in a Seahawks uniform. Like, there are so many things to think about from this era that I look back and I'm just like, oh, like, this is not a fun experience in some ways.
Yeah. And yet they were extremely fun and exciting for, you know, 3, 4 years.
Right.
Which
almost won 2 Super
Bowls. It's a long time. And it's hard right now because the recency bias would lead me to say, no, I'm angry with them for not maximizing the Russell Wilson era. And I'm extremely displeased with the vast majority of personnel, coaching, hiring, you know, decisions that they've made over the last year. Right. But we're not all the way through the Russell Wilson. And I see this as more of a Russell Wilson era than a Pete Carroll, John Schneider era at this point. Mm-hmm. Okay. In terms of sort of scarcity and what he brings to the table. So to me, if this organization, if what we're seeing this year with Schottenheimer, with the way, you know, the decisions that they're making, if that continues for 2-3 years, which I would be surprised if the front office was given that kind of leash, but if that happens, mm-hmm. then yes, I think I will look back with a lot of negativity. So we'll see. And that's why when leading off, I said I was kind of bummed about the win, even though, on most levels, that's not really true. But mm-hmm. Brian Schottenheimer has been an abject disaster in every sense of the word. And my concern at this point is merely that winning sustains his tenure in Seattle.
What would be a successful season for you at this point? Like, as a fan, what would be the ideal outcome for you at the end of 2018?
Moving on from Brian Schottenheimer during the season. So Russell Wilson attempted, this is at Mike Sawyer tweeted this, Russell Wilson attempted only one pass farther than 15 yards. Mm. You saw that they had zero third downs.
They won with no third down conversion.
So yes, moving on from him is my number one. That would be it. And I think we talked about this before the season. I said I wanted mm-hmm. to see some development from some of the younger guys. So that would be a thing too. I just want some indication that this team is not actively sabotaging Russell Wilson. That's it.
I mean, do you feel...
Because right now, that's what it looks like.
Do you feel like Pete should go if they don't show those signs of life from the younger players?
So let's say, like, a realistic season. Let's say this team finishes, like, 7-9, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Which feels realistic.
That would be my guess.
Yeah, something like that. Would they move on from Pete Carroll then? I think if this offense looks as bad as it has throughout the rest of the season, which seems mm-hmm. likely at this point, given right, yeah. Something has to change. I don't know. It's really, I mean, you know, winning a Super Bowl buys you a lot of time in the NFL, but I certainly think they would have to move on from Schottenheimer at least. Yes. At the very least, but I'm very disheartened by, you know, Pete Carroll hiring him, sticking with, you know, that he does not look around the NFL and see what's happening and that he's moving in the opposite direction is incredibly disheartening.
So, you know how people who are, you know, how liberal folks might look back at the George W. Bush era and they're like, oh man, I just missed that guy, even though, you know, he was not especially loved. Is Daryl Bevel the George W. Bush of the Seattle Seahawks?
This is what Seahawks, I tweeted this, but this is what you get for all those hashtag fire Bevel. This is your punishment for that. This is karma. Daryl Bevel was a good person. He didn't deserve it.
He paints veterans.
I was fine with Daryl Bevel. I always thought he was underrated. In 2015, mm-hmm. or maybe 14, I think 15, Seattle had one of the most, you know, explosive offenses in the NFL. So mm-hmm. it's not his fault that his playbook was hampered by the presence of Tom Cable, run game coordinator.
Happier days. I'm not going to extend the metaphor to who Tom Cable is in the Bush administration, but you can probably figure it out. In terms of the Rams, who are now, 2 weeks ago, I went to Vegas. I looked at the odds for the NFC West. The Rams were 1-30 to win the NFC West. Since then, they've gone 2-0. Jimmy Garoppolo is out for the year. Earl Thomas is out for the year. That might be the two best players in this division, or the two most important players in some ways in this division, outside of maybe Russell Wilson, mm-hmm. Patrick Peterson. But basically, they're in great shape. They are quite comfortably the favorites in the NFC West. Last year, think about what they did. They won the division. They sat their guys, sat their stars, Todd Gurley, Jared Goff, those sort of players in week 17. And then they were sloppy in the playoffs. They lost to the Falcons. It was not an impressive performance. What do you think they do this year? Didn't they look at that and say, oh, well, I don't know if we should sit our guys? Or, I mean, they might have this division locked up by week 13 or 14. It would not shock me if they were way ahead.
I'm glad that the Rams are so dominant that it's week 4 and we're talking about their sit-start strategy for week 17. Like, that's just great.
Yes.
I forget the NFC West, by the way. Just looking around the NFL, the Rams, to me, I don't know if you agree, they seem so much better than every other team.
Yes.
I don't know. Yes, I mean, the Chiefs don't have a defense, so, I their offense is obviously as good as the Rams, if not better, but that's, you know, is there a word for when you go first and 32 in DVOA? It's like a 7-10 split of DVOA. That's what the Chiefs are doing right now. The Rams are a little beat up, but I still think they'll be fine. So as far as their approach to it, I don't know. It's curious. Who are they playing in week 17?
they play the, I'll get this up right now, but I'm thinking about this from a fantasy perspective, because if you have like Todd Gurley and Brandon Cooks and Jared Goff
and the
Rams team,
the end of the year.
And you're like, you don't have them for the entire fantasy playoffs, like that might actually cause Sean McVay to get some legitimate criticism, mm-hmm. which could be great. They host the Bears, they're at the Bears in week 14, they host the Eagles in week 15, and they're at Arizona week 16, hosting mm-hmm. San Francisco week 17. So you'd figure, that Eagles game could actually figure into something meaningful. The Bears game could factor into something meaningful.
Yeah,
in
that's
terms
the one
of,
you want to sit Goff.
Against Max. I mean, like, you know, those games could actually figure in terms of seeding and whatnot in the NFC, but would it shock you at all if they sat Goff and Gurley week 16 and week 17 in probably two meaningless division games?
I don't know. I think the talking heads would just go nuts based on what happened last year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inclined to think Sean McVay doesn't care, though, what's talking. I mean, I don't know. I think you could see a lot of these guys sitting week 17 for sure.
Mm-hmm. Rams are 61.7% per FPI to make the Super Bowl out of the NFC. Would you take the Rams over the field in the NFC?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Who's the second best team in the NFC?
Maybe the Bears. I don't know, maybe the Saints? Maybe the Saints got their defense going? I mean, you get Bears, Saints, Eagles, Packers, Washington, even strangely. All right, let's get to a team that could possibly have used Earl Thomas in the NFC South in a moment. But first, wanted to talk about our friends at Hotel Tonight, a website and an application that I have used for many years now. Years past, of course, I would go somewhere for work. I'd hang out with some friends. Maybe my friend's apartment would not be the most comfortable place for me to stay. And I'd say, well, let me look for a hotel room here on this app. Hotel Tonight would get me a great deal from some of the unsold rooms at hotels of all different kinds, whether it's a luxe hotel, whether it's a cheap hotel, whether it's a nice normal hotel, whatever option you want. Hotel Tonight has that on their app. And well, I went there, got a great stay, had a comfortable place to stay. I'll tell you, with my app, it was quick, it was affordable, it was easy. Things have changed. Hotel Tonight still has that. You don't have to worry about that going away. But now what makes it even better is that you can plan stuff up to 100 days in advance in many locations with Hotel Tonight. So now if I'm going on a vacation with some friends, my partner, I can look on Hotel Tonight, see if I get a great deal. Go ahead and book it up to 100 days in advance. It's a game changer in terms of how I look for hotels. I travel a bunch for work, for pleasure. I always want to get a good deal. I'm very cheap and very frugal. And like I said, a Hotel Tonight has all kinds of options for what kind of different hotels you're looking for, whether you want a fancy hotel on the beach, whether you want something that's just cheap to get you a place to rest your head on a busy stay. Hotel Tonight has all kinds of options. I'm going to LA in November. That's one of those beach trips. I obviously have a beach body. I want to show that off and flaunt it. I can't say that with a straight face, but you get the idea. I want to hang out by the beach, have a nice warm vacation in the middle of November. I went to Hotel Tonight, got a great deal on a stay there later on this year. So if you want to check out Hotel Tonight, I'd say download the app or go to hoteltonight.com. You'll get a really great deal at a great hotel, whether it's for tonight or 100 days in advance. Check out hoteltonight.com or the Hotel Tonight app now. Now back to the show. Outside of the Chiefs, who are just so bludgeonly good that they are able to just destroy other teams, the Falcons are like this weird mix of wildly entertaining and then incredibly exasperating at the same time.
So they went, what is it, like 10 out of 11 on scoring on red zone drives? It's something like absurd, right? Like
they scored 11 times in a row after the Eagles game where they were abysmal and everyone wanted Sark to get fired. They scored, as I was documenting on my Twitter, which you are probably blocked from seeing, but if you're not, it's at Bill Barnwell. The Falcons scored 11 consecutive touchdowns in the red zone, which is absurd. I did not think they were actually that good.
I made the mistake of tweeting, put some respect on Sark's name. I can't remember the play. It was something that it was yesterday because I watched most of the game, and maybe it was, Julio, it was someone else. But anyways, they did something cool, and Falcons fans were like, not yet. You just scored 11 consecutive touchdowns.
Were Falcons fans angry at you for making fun of Matt Ryan for dressing like the most conservative dad on the way to the game?
Not Falcons fans, but a certain sect of Twitter that I will not name was upset with me for making fun of a certain kind of man. Mm. Very gently, to be clear. By the way, after that Brian Schottenheimer conversation that you and I just had.
Yes.
if you complain about Sark in front of me, I will kick you out of my house. So, you know, like, do not. Infuriating. But anyways, you know, it was funny with Matt Ryan. I was going back and trying to pull just some statistics on his performance over the last 3 weeks, and he's been really incredible since that Eagles game, just ranking in the top three in just about every metric for a quarterback you can come up with. He did, in this the last game, the Bengals game, he had a bad drive in the end and almost threw a pick six. But by and large, he's been very good. Obviously, Calvin Ridley. They've had some really good drafts, by the way, because two of the guys who really have jumped out to me are Tack McKinley and Calvin Ridley. Yes. Both of their top picks have been excellent. The problem, quite obviously, is the defense, which, you know, we don't need to go over all of the injuries. It's pretty obvious. But one thing, Bill, that comes to my mind when the Panthers signed Eric Reed was, I don't want to say this was strategic, but God, the Falcons could use Eric Reed.
Yeah, they could use.
It almost, doesn't it feel like they were just keeping him away from New Orleans and Atlanta in some way?
It seems like part of it. I mean, they could use Earl Thomas with a broken leg at safety, and it might be better than the options they have at the moment. I mean, like, it's just, this was the most obvious fit for Earl Thomas for the entirety of the Earl Thomas holdout / semi-holdout. I mean, they play the same scheme as the Seahawks do with Dan Quinn there. They lost Keanu Neal to a season-ending injury in week one. That should have been it. That should have been like, okay, we are good making this trade. Maybe you wait until week two and you're like, oh, our defense suddenly can't stop running backs from catching the football. Maybe we need someone who can possibly help us commit to stopping players in front of us, knowing we have a safety who can pretty much cover everything behind us. And in watching this game against the Bengals, there were so many plays where the Bengals were able to exploit the Falcons up the seam for big plays. And it's like, oh, well, maybe you have a safety who could control both teams in the cover three. Who's a guy who could do that? Oh, it's the one of the best safeties in football, happens to be available for trade. I mean, you know, the injuries do
not. Not Brian Poole.
It's not Brian Poole. And it's not DeMonte Casey. I mean, injuries suck. And obviously losing Deion Jones, losing Ken O'Neill, those are two super valuable players. But there's a ton of young talent on this defense that's supposed to be playing at a high level. Vic Beasley has one sack, I believe. You mentioned Tack McKinley. He has five sacks. That's great. But Grady Jarrett has not had a sack so far this year. Desmond Trufant, Robert Alford, two highly paid cornerbacks who are pretty good, and I've generally been pretty good. They're getting torched because there's no pass rush, and they're not able to hold up in coverage long enough to make plays. And I don't want to take credit away from the Bengals, who we'll get to, but I mean, this is a defense that it's just they don't seem capable of stopping anybody. And for the Falcons' offense, I mean, they scored 36 points. They had 419 passing yards, over 500 yards of offense. And granted, it did come down to a final play from the Bengals to score a touchdown with 7 seconds left. But I mean, this is a defense that just, not only do they seem like they're incapable of stopping things, it's hard to believe that suddenly the switch is going to flip and they're suddenly going to be able to return to form.
Right, especially with injuries. But you've always been a Vic Beasley truther, I feel like.
He's like, not that good. He's like, but I mean, you know, like you have to hope that, okay, well, we have Tack McKinley attracting pressure on the side of the field.
That was one takeaway I got from watching this, is he is much more explosive and disruptive. Sorry, yeah. Between explosive and disruptive than Vic Beasley, and it really pops. I still think Grady Jarrett, you know, he's pretty good, although they are allowing a lot of yards per rush. But
They're the 31st in first down percentage with the run, which, I mean, Grady Jarrett's not going to necessarily be like the guy who's going to be your run stuffer, and that was really Dontari Poe's role last year, but you do kind of have to hope that he's going to help out there. Like, maybe just on the way to the quarterback, he's going to see a running back and be like, I'm going to tackle this gentleman, and we'll get to the next play here.
I'm going to tackle this gentleman.
I mean, you know, it's just,
I mean, the entire spine of this defense was ripped out, and it just shows, and I don't, you know, we were talking about who is the second best team in the NFC. Even though I don't think the conference has quite been what we thought it might be, I don't think this I just don't think this team is good. I mean, the offense is probably good enough to keep them in most conference games, right? Because they're going to, and most of these conference games, by the way, are going to be a ton of offense regardless. But I don't, you're right, the situation is not going to get any better for them.
Yeah, Julio Jones, by the way, you mentioned him earlier, with regards to Calvin Ridley, who's playing at a high level. Julio Jones, by the way, is on pace for a 2008 yard receiving season with zero touchdowns. I want this to happen so much.
Is there a better situation in the NFL than Calvin Ridley?
Just seeing single coverage every single play.
Every single time, yeah. At some point, that's gotta soften up a little bit. But
yeah, I mean, they moved Marshon Lattimore on him last week in the Saints game for part of the second half. And I mean, Julio Jones is playing at a high level. The offense is not the problem here. They've lost Devontae Freeman. Really haven't skipped a beat. The running game has not been incredible, but Ito Smith has been just fine as the second half of that running back rotation with Tevin Coleman. I mean, they need to start forcing stops and creating takeaways on defense. They have 3 interceptions so far this year. I mean, Deion Jones had one of them and he's no longer around. I mean, this is a team that is not creating plays on defense. They're not putting the opposing offense in situations where they're going to struggle. And I mean, they really didn't have much resistance against the Bengals, who I wrote about this in my column today, the awards column. You know, Bill Lazor, the Bengals offensive coordinator, was fired in Miami. He was the Bengals quarterbacks coach. He got promoted last year. Andy Dalton and Bill Lazor have been really good, way better than I think I realized, since they kind of came together in September of last season. All right, Mina, well, let's get to other teams from the AFC North here in a second. But first, wanted to talk about our friends at SeatGeek. And of course, Mina mentioned earlier, we once did a live podcast in New York several years ago. People who brought that podcast to you were our friends at SeatGeek. And whether it was for that show, whether it was for the live Bill Barnwell shows we did a couple years ago, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a sporting event, whether it's a concert, no matter what you need tickets to get, you can find tickets for that game at SeatGeek. I was in D.C. last weekend. I wanted to check out the Capitals. I am a lapsed Capitals fan. They were playing a preseason game. I went to SeatGeek, got tickets to the game, had a good time, enjoyed myself. SeatGeek, of course, as you know from the show in the past, they are aggregating tickets from all over the web, and they're using their deal score technology to rate them, so you are getting the deal you want. You want tickets in the front row? Well, they're going to tell you, hey, these front row tickets are good. You don't want these front row tickets because they are charging too much for these seats. You want tickets just anywhere in the stadium, anywhere in the arena? SeatGeek can get you that too. No matter what kind of ticket you want, you can get affordable tickets reliably sent to you via SeatGeek. And if you want to follow my lead, you can have the SeatGeek app on your phone. It's the easiest way to shop for tickets. You can also use the desktop site at SeatGeek.com, but I would say recommend the app. It's what I use personally. And if you want to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase, just download the SeatGeek app and enter in promo code Barnwell today. That's my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Promo code Barnwell for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. Now back to the show.
You want to talk about the Bengals a little bit, or you've got a little bit later?
I have a Bengals guest down line. We'll just talk a little bit of Bengals. We'll talk a little bit more about that,
sure,
I think, on Thursday. But, I mean, this is an offense that, you know, they've lost Joe Mixon. They lost A.J. Green for a stretch last week. Tyler Eifert, of course, went down with that gruesome ankle injury during this game. They're down their starting center in Billy Price. This is an offense that you would kind of figure, okay, we can make excuses for this offense. And they haven't played the toughest slate of defenses so far, but they really blew up the Ravens in the first half of that game a couple weeks ago. They've been good pretty much.
We now know is probably one of the better defenses in the NFL, for sure.
I mean, even the Panthers, they had Andy Dalton had 4 interceptions in that game, but a couple of them really weren't his fault, or they were really late in the contest. This is an offense that I think is really underrated right now when you think about some of the best offenses in football.
Completely. And we've talked a little bit about, I don't know, maybe just, you know, we talk sometimes just casually, just as friends, about the NFL. And you know, so what's gone right for Andy Dalton this year? Why he looks a little bit more like 2015 Andy Dalton, never forget. A big part of that is obviously the changes in the offensive line, getting Russell Bodine out of there at center. You know, his protection is significantly better. And I think one thing, I mean, it's just very obvious at this point that that's makes a tremendous impact on any quarterback's performance, but especially on Andy Dalton's. While watching this game, Bill, I was very nervous when Tyler Eifert, I mean, I was heartbroken, right? Because poor Tyler Eifert's already had so many terrible injuries. But while you're watching, there were a couple drives afterwards where Dalton struggled, and I said to myself, oh no, right? Because I do believe Tyler Eifert's presence in that offense, and he was there for, I think, all of 2015, Anyways, so his presence in that offense completely changes the complexion of, I mean, not only is he an outlet for Andy Dalton, but A.J. Green, who does get double covered a lot, you know, will leave him open sometimes in the middle. And they really are able to exploit the presence of both of those players. So when he got injured and went off the field, I just, my instinct was like, this is over, this is done. Mm-hmm. But then Andy Dalton started hitting Tyler Boyd. And yes. I think what that was my big takeaway from this game is that he's his number two guy now, right? Because they haven't, losing Sanu, you know, losing Marvin Jones, you see this, they can't just have A.J. Green. Mm-hmm. And to have Tyler Boyd emerge as that sort of outlet for Andy Dalton, I think, is my hope that they can keep this going.
Yeah, I think Tyler Boyd is really a safety valve for Andy Dalton. I think when he is in trouble now, that is the first guy he looks for. And I think he's really valuable in that role. I mean, he's not going to get, you know, a ton of big plays. He's had some big plays this year, but he's not going to be, I think, consistently like a guy who has, you know, 20 yards per reception. But he's a useful underneath receiver. And I mean, for a guy who really was written off this time last year, who was a healthy scratch for stretches of last season, who really wasn't even getting significant touches, had a little bit at the end of last year. But I mean, he's a legitimate number two receiver at this point. And sometimes this happens to guys. They break out after 2 or 3 years. They do find that role. To pick a player who I think he might necessarily remind me of, he could kind of be someone like Jermaine Kearse in this Bengals offense where, I'm going to hit Jermaine Kearse at some point when we do a podcast. Like he could be a guy who I don't think he's going to win you a game on his own, but he's going to come up with plays. He's going to be a useful part of the running game as a blocker. He's going to be, you know, a guy who, at least if you're going to double team AJ Green, he can probably beat your number two cornerback, or he can beat your linebacker in safety and zone coverage on every snap. And I think with the Bengals in the past, like it was really, okay, well, it's going to be AJ Green, or we're going to be stuck throwing to Brandon LaFell. We're going to have to hope that John Ross is healthy for this stretch. We're going to have to hope that Tyler Kroft can be a guy. And we saw, I mean, Tyler Kroft dropped a pass that turned into an interception this game, and the Bengals really didn't skip a beat. They were just fine and moving the ball with the guys they had left by the end of the game.
Let me read you the 2015 Bengals offensive depth chart. First of all, Whitworth, Clint Bowling, Russell Bodine, Kevin Zeiler, Andre Smith on the line, Eifert, A.J. Green, Sanu, Marvin Jones. I mean, I know I've just said a lot of these names, so I'm kind of just repeating myself. But it was absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Jeez.
It was an incredible offense in terms of talent. And, you know, we saw it. When everything's right for Andy Dalton, he is capable of being a great quarterback. I think just when things go wrong, especially over the past couple of years, they didn't have the infrastructure to succeed. I mean, the line was a mess. When AJ Green was hurt, they didn't have that other option at receiver. Eifert was pretty much gone for the last 2 years. I mean, when he has people around him, which is true of about 90% of the quarterbacks in the NFL, he's capable of winning games. And I mean, this defense is someone who we certainly know they have talent on defense. They have pass rushers. They have a really imposing at times front four. Questions in the secondary. Drake Kirkpatrick, I think, is probably not especially good. But I mean, this is a team that it's not crazy to imagine them winning a bunch of games in the AFC.
Mm. Yeah, I would say the secondary jumped out to me. I mean, again, there, you know, it's Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley and Matt Ryan, so it's not entirely fair, but they did get both Jackson and Kirkpatrick got pretty torched on Saturday. But yeah, they're just a very balanced team. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say. Like, we talked a lot about unbalanced teams, and we just talked about the Falcons, and looking at this team, I do think you're right. They don't have huge glaring holes.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of teams that have glaring holes and are imbalanced, let's talk about the Sunday night game and talk about the Pittsburgh Steelers, who, I mean, I wrote before the year that the Steelers were going to decline. I did expect they were going to be not as good as the team we saw a year ago, but I kind of figured like, oh, they'll be 10-6 or 11-5. Ben will get hurt for a game. You know, Le'Veon Bell will come back around week two or week three, and they'll struggle maybe a bit here or there, but they'll be just fine. And now, I think we're getting to the point where I'm starting to believe that there are fundamental flaws with this football team. And they're down to, according to the Football Power Index, a 22.5% shot of making the playoffs, which is pretty low after for a team that kind of you figured, well, they're guaranteed basically to make the playoffs out of the AFC and possibly make a run deep into the postseason. I mean, are you as skeptical? Or like, do you think that 22.5% chance is too low when you think about the Steelers' chances going forward?
You know, I haven't looked at the schedule, so just purely based on the talent of the team, It is funny, right? So let's talk about the AFC North.
Okay.
How would you rank the teams right now? It's really hard.
Yeah, I think I would put the Ravens ahead.
Just purely based on talent and goodness.
Are you saying good goodness on air?
Well, I mean, like, not on playoff chances based on record and potential and stuff, all that. So I just mean, like, who's the best to the worst? Mm-hmm.
I would say the Ravens, to me, are the number one, just because I think when they're, like, on their game, they are the best of those three teams. I would put the Browns fourth. We'll worry about the Browns some other time. We don't just talk about the Browns. A lot of people are talking about the Browns. But we can get, you know, I think the Steelers are better than the Bengals, but not by a ton. And certainly, like, I have more faith that the Bengals are a more well-rounded team than the Steelers through four games.
Yeah, that's certainly fair. You know, we talked about the Falcons defense and some of their deficiencies, which are caused by injury in their case, but you know, how we don't see it going better. I don't really see a path for the Steelers defense to make a market improvement, to be blunt. But, you know, setting aside, we know that, right? The offense last night, I guess what really jumped out to me is, like, this whole, with that offense, we've always wondered, okay, they've got arguably one of the better quarterbacks, one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, arguably the best wide receiver, arguably the best running back, right? Yes. And there was always this question of who's most responsible for the success, who, and I really think what we've seen this season is that they all really need to work in tandem, okay? And you see, and last night, Antonio Brown, they used him a lot to open up the middle of the field.
Yes.
You know, he was running. Yeah. And that's why you saw guys like Vance McDonald, you know, was wide open a lot, which is great. But Roethlisberger wasn't connecting with Brown when he did hit him. And there's something off there. And I can't, you know, it's very obvious James Conner's not Le'Veon Bell, right? We see that now. Through no fault. It's just very few people in this universe are. I don't want to say, like, his absence is causing all of this, but it does seem like there's been a lot of unforeseen consequences. Let's put it that way. It's like one of those things where you take out one piece. There's probably, like, a term for that, like a metaphor or something, where, you know what I mean? Like, where you take out, like, one ingredient from the stew and suddenly the whole thing tastes kind of weird.
Is that a Pareto efficiency? The Steelers offense, I don't know what that actually is, but it feels like that's something I've heard in context with the Pareto efficiency. If only we had a business journalist on here to possibly discuss.
Let's go with the stew.
Let's go with the stew. That's fair.
I don't know. I mean, you know what I mean, though, right? Like,
yes.
And I don't know. I don't think Ben's looked that great. Even the Bucks game where, you know, the announcer, oh, Ben Roethlisberger, he made a lot of bad throws too. Mm-hmm. And he does that every game. I always see a lot of interceptions left on the field when he plays. Mm-hmm. And I really saw that last night. I don't know. I just don't think that I agree with your ranking of the teams, although I think Flacco could certainly turn into a pumpkin at any point.
Yes.
But that defense is very, very good.
I mean, we're seeing with James Conner, like I think one of the issues here is not even that they don't have Le'Veon Bell, but we've seen two of these four games now, the Chiefs game in week two and now this game against the Ravens, that when they get down early, they were down 14-0 in this game. They were down 21-0, I believe, in the Chiefs game. Even if they come back on offense, they pretty much don't think about James Conner as a viable part of the offense. In that game, he had 8 carries for 17 yards in the Chiefs game. This one, 9 carries for 19 yards. Like, if they get down early, with Le'Veon Bell, I figure, well, they're still going to give him the ball, and he's still going to make plays, and even if he's not going to solve their defensive problems, at least they're going to have time for the defense to kind of get their bearings, maybe possibly make some adjustments. I don't know what those adjustments are going to be honest with you, but at least there's an idea that they can change things. Whereas with this Steelers team, whether it's an offensive choice, whether it's just that they don't trust James Conner to be, you know, a fundamental success in the running game, like, they've been throwing pretty much the entire game to hopefully catch up in two of their losses. And I don't, when you talk about the issues with Ben and this offense, like, it's a fundamentally different team when you don't have to worry about Le'Veon Bell coming out of the backfield. Le'Veon Bell is a runner. When you know the Steelers are going to throw the football, like, yeah, you can kind of clog those throwing lanes and just sort of hopefully, you know, focus on stopping Antonio Brown and Juju Smith-Schuster.
Yeah, and it sort of, to bring it all full circle, it does cut to the Earl Thomas conversation, which is the lady. It does feel, although, you know, if he gets paid, he could still emerge as the winner in all of this, right? Because he would have preserved his health by not playing and whatever. But who knows right now? We can't speculate as to that. But I think it's undeniable that his absence is, for the reasons you just outlined, being felt in this offense. So it's certainly making a case for his value. But the question is that value, case versus value specific to this team? I don't think it's specific to this team, but is it bigger for this team than it would be, you know, for other teams in the NFL? I don't know. It's a very good offensive line, so
I think they
would be able to get more out of Connor than they've gotten.
I think it is just because I don't think they, no, it's all good. I don't think they have like that sort of like for like replacement. And I don't know that you can have anyone who's going to replace Le'Veon Bell in the way that he's Le'Veon Bell. And I think James Connor in week one was just fine, but I think they need to have someone who at least is more of a threat in the passing game, or at least even if they had like, you know, Darren Sproles or someone like Darren Sproles.
Yeah.
Where,
do they not have?
I mean, their backup is Stephen Ridley. Who Stephen Ridley? Number one, I was shocked Stephen Ridley was still in the NFL, which is
no idea
crazy to me. Because if you asked me when he played in the NFL, I would guess maybe 2002. Like I figured he was one of the guys running against the Rams in that Super Bowl with the first Tom Brady Super Bowl. I mean, you know, they did not invest a lot in their running back situation, and I think when you have a guy like Le'Veon Bell, who you know is probably going to hold out or probably not going to be thrilled about playing early in the year and has an injury history, I think you have to invest more in your backup running back situation. And, I can't make the same case in defense because there were years past where for cap reasons, because they were struggling with their decisions, they had a bunch of unrestricted free agents or guys who were just off the street playing meaningful roles in the postseason. And it's like, well, you kind of screwed this other thing up. And so this is why you're stuck playing guys who aren't really that good in secondary, but that excuse is gone. I mean, they didn't have Mike Hilton in the game yesterday. They didn't have Morgan Burnett, who they signed in free agency. You know, well, those guys are going to help. But, I mean, this is a defense that should have Joe Hayden and Terrell Edmonds, who was a first-round pick this past year, and then Artie Burns and Sean Davis, who were first- and second-round picks in 2016. Burns and Davis should be playing at a high level at this point. This is a team that, for decades, their story has been, we're going to develop young talent better than anybody else in football. And those guys are not playing well. Sean Davis has been a mess. Mm-hmm. Artie Burns has been targeted significantly in coverage. They had, they're playing Cody Sensabaugh, who is a fifth cornerback on most teams for meaningful snaps, and he's not looking good. Edmonds, again, as a rookie, has not been especially impressive. He was run over by Kareem Hunt in that Chiefs game. Yep. John Brown ran past him for a touchdown on the Sunday night game. This should be fixed by now. And quite clearly, it is not fixed.
Yeah, I don't think Mike Tomlin's on the hot seat. This team has just had too much success, but I could certainly see them moving on from Keith Butler, you know, after this season. Or maybe even midseason, I don't know. But it is, when your team is that successful and you finish, you go to the playoffs, you know, most years, and you do pick later in drafts, it's understandable that you're not going to hit on every pick, but you have to hit on free agency, and they just haven't. Right. So, and you have to make the right. I mean, this was like a very foreseeable disaster in a lot of ways. Right. I think, you know, a lot of people were puzzled by the Edmonds pick given the needs that they had that they didn't fill in free agency too. So it does feel like as much of a managerial failure as a coaching one. But I wouldn't be surprised if there was a shakeup in this organization in the middle of the season if this defense doesn't look even a little bit better.
That seems like it's sort of the place for them to go. We have to finish up. I feel bad that we didn't get to the Ravens all that much. I mean, is there any takeaway you have from this game and from the first four games of the Ravens so far this year?
The defense is very good. This is a good defense, right? As far as the offense goes, like, Joe Flacco looks good, but, you know,
do you trust him, though?
No, I don't. I don't know why anyone does. Like, we have 3 years of a 3 year sample size in which he's not been good. So, you know, it's great that, you know, and I don't know how many times we can hear that bringing in Lamar Jackson. Well, that's a whole other issue, by the way, how they use him, but that it motivated him. And I don't want to get into that, but, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, and obviously here's the takeaway. The offensive line looked really good to me. And that, when we talk about like Andy Dalton and how the line helped him, I'm sure that's played a much bigger role than the threat of Lamar Jackson looming. Having a competent offensive line probably helps Joe Flacco a bit more than that.
And the presence of a different receiving core. And I think John Brown, I mean, I wrote about comeback player of the year in my column today, and John Brown has to be in the running for that. I mean, he looks like the guy who was terrifying for the Cardinals in 2015.
Yep. glad he's no longer on the Cardinals. Yeah, by the way, final note, Josh Rosen looked pretty good to me. Wow. I don't know why I just said that. It's completely tangential and irrelevant. I meant to say that when we were talking about the Seahawks, but mm-hmm. I was impressed by him.
Well,
but yeah, he could certainly use a John Brown.
Yes, he could use a John Brown. He could use several of them. I still think Larry Fitzgerald should get traded somewhere. I know he's not going to because he doesn't want to leave, but it just makes sense for everyone involved.
Let's wrap up with this. If you could gift Larry Fitzgerald to any team in the NFL, who would you gift him to?
That's a good question. The Steelers make a lot of sense, but I don't think they don't need another wide receiver. What about the Jags? I can see Larry Fitzgerald helping out the Jacksonville Jaguars.
I'm not just going to not talk about the Jags offense because anyone who thinks they know if Blake Bortles is going to play well or not is lying. Like, you just don't know, okay?
I don't think Blake Bortles
knows. I would go with the Packers.
Yeah, I could see that too. I could see him playing, you know, being an upgrade on like Randall Cobb and giving them an extra option.
A bunch of ugly drops mm-hmm. against the Bills, who, you know. And him and Rodgers are buds, so be cute.
Well, he likes to golf, and I don't know that Green Bay is the best place to golf, but I think it could be worth an option. Mina Kimes, of course, you are all across ESPN programming. I'm sure our listeners know where to check you out on ESPN and on social media, but please plug all your various appearances and ESPN properties.
Well, the main thing right now is Bootleg with Mina Kimes. If you rate and review and you leave a question in your review, I will answer it on the podcast unless it's weird. So please rate, please review, and yeah, leave a question.
Do you want to plug your Twitter as well?
It's Mina Kimes. It's pretty intuitive.
It's Mina Kimes. All right, Mina, we're going to, of course, always a pleasure to have you on. We're going to come back after the break here with ESPN's Kevin Seifert, talk about the Vikings, and talk about some of the refereeing concerns of the first week of the season back here on the Bill Barnwell Show in a moment. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, and joining me to finish up here, talking about the Minnesota Vikings, talking about some of the refereeing concerns, which he monitors on a week-to-week basis for us here at ESPN. It is Kevin Seifert. Kevin, how are you?
I'm very good, Bill. How are you, sir?
I am good. I will say that a team that is not good right now, perhaps, Minnesota Vikings, who are 1-2-1. And, well, you might have figured they would lose to the Rams in Los Angeles, a very exciting game, certainly. Maybe raise Mike Zimmer's blood pressure some, seeing what happened on defense. But this is a team that was expected to compete for a Super Bowl this year. And they are 1-2-1 through four games. So, Kevin, let me ask you, as someone who lives in the area, follows this team closely, do you think there are reasons to be concerned about the Vikings after 4 weeks?
You know, if you look at last year, I think people forget they did start 2-2, so a similar start, and ended up winning the division and going to the NFC Championship game. The concern now, unlike last year, which was at quarterback, and where Case Keenum kind of rescued them, the concern now is obviously defense. And part of me thinks that if you went into this season, if you were any NFL team and you went into the season thinking you would win with really good defense, then you picked the wrong year. Because offenses, for a lot of reasons, some under their control and some not, are really dominating early on. And so if you have a team built around defense, that's not good unless your offense can also score 30-plus points a game. The Vikings actually have that, but their defense has still really not – been the same since the second half of that Saints game playoffs last year. And so that is something to be concerned about. That's something that they really, the way this team was built to play really good defense and have a more explosive, consistent offense last year, the first part of that formula does not look encouraging right now. We'll see if Mike Zimmer can make some adjustments, but they have a few personnel issues that might be tough to overcome. And so I think there's definitely room to for concern when you have a defensive-minded head coach and certainly, in a lot of ways, a salary cap-focused team that's struggling to stop the other team.
Yeah, and certainly last year, you think about this defense, and one of the things fans maybe don't think about very frequently, but that comes up a lot as you research who wins football games, is why this was maybe the healthiest defense in football a year ago in terms of keeping their 11 starters who they wanted on the field in week one. Outside of Shreve Floyd, who had that, wasn't expected to play last year. You know, the defense was the healthiest in football last year, right up there with the Jags. And this year, obviously we have the Everson Griffin situation, which, you know, is still sort of evolving and we're still not 100% sure about what's happening there, but He's not available. He missed the last 2 weeks. They obviously missed him on the pass rush. Xavier Rhodes is playing through a hamstring injury. Maybe he hasn't been 100%. Trey Waynes went out with a concussion. There are injury concerns with this defense that we didn't see last year. And while they are, I would say, on paper, certainly one of the deepest defenses in the league, I mean, it's just going to be tough to really play at that high of a level when you don't have all your stars playing at 100% in the way you did perhaps a year ago.
Yeah, and that's, and I know we talked a little bit last year, and people in town, I think, recognized it as well, as sometimes the window just opens for you and everybody's healthy and all the things are working right and you just have to try to ride it to the Super Bowl. And they fell one game short of that last year, and it was certainly unreasonable to think that they were going to have the same luck this year. You mentioned their backfield, defensive backfield especially. Like, I don't think Trey Waynes has been healthy the entire season either. He had the concussion against the Rams the other night, but he's had some other leg issues and has not played very well. I thought they would be a position could withstand some injuries that you assume in terms of regression to the mean would happen. It would be in the, at the cornerback position, because they had Mackenzie Alexander. They drafted in the second round a few years ago and has had the requisite 2 to 3 years of development in the Mike Zimmer scheme. They also drafted Mike Hughes in the first round, who's really fast and had a pretty good training camp. But Alexander has had to play a lot, and he has not been that good. Hughes has been a rookie, and you know, he's not Denzel Ward, so he's struggled some. They try to run a big nickel package with this guy, Jayron Kearse, who's a great special teams player and looks like Cam Chancellor when you see him on the field, but doesn't have, you know, the kind of coverage skills to allow you to play in that big nickel situation. So, while they have some players that have some pedigree in the depth in the defensive backfield, it has not, paid off quite yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely a concern where, you know, this was a season where you kind of looked at it maybe before the year and said, okay, well, the defense, we know it's going to be good. And the offense, well, we added Kirk Cousins. We upgraded at the most important position in football. So you figure, well, great defense, maybe an improved offense. Even after Case Keenum played well last year, we get Dalvin Cook back. It's going to help our running game. You know, all the important guys are back. It's going to be great. And the offense hasn't necessarily been bad for most of this year. But the one concern you might look at is, you think about that 2016 team, what really caused them to struggle on offense was the offensive line was hit with injuries. And there just wasn't a lot of talent to work with on that team. So offensive line was much healthier last year, but this year we're seeing, even going back into the summer, major concerns about the offensive line's ability to stay healthy.
Yes, and it was a really ominous start. You know, you start off the training camp with Nick Easton, who was supposed to be their left guard, and he shows up with a neck injury that ends up costing him the entire season. And then Pat Elflein, who was their really good rookie center last year, had off-season surgery, and he basically missed training camp in the first games of the year, and I think this past game was the first time he started. They're moving Mike Remmers from right tackle to right guard and back and forth. And so, yeah, it started at the very beginning and it really has never stopped. And it was a little bit of an auspicious beginning and just made you, as we talked about on defense as well, made you realize just how as much off-season discussion and analysis you can do on how talented a team is, that unexpected things are bound to happen, and that was one of them, and that really has affected them. I mean, their running game has not been very good, and Kirk Cousins has been getting pressured a fair bit and hit a lot. Some of that's his fault for not getting rid of the ball. I think that was the case on that game-ending fumble against the Rams the other night, but he is getting, pummeled, hit around there good in the pocket. And so something to keep in mind, as the season moves on, no team is perfect. Every team has flaws. But if you, in addition to looking at who the opponents are, I mean, tying the Packers in Green Bay, that was going to be a tough game to win. Losing to the Rams in LA by 7 points on a short week, that's not the worst loss in the world. The Bills loss will really come back to haunt them, I think, even though it was an AFC game and not really a playoff tiebreaker type thing. But that's the one real anomaly that's hard to figure out how that happened. But add it all together, you know, you're a first-place team, you're going to have a tough schedule, and if you want to repeat as a first-place team, you got to win those games, and they have not been able to do that.
That's the thing I wanted to ask, is that you know, you think about the bigger picture with this team, and you look at the schedule, and you say, well, like you said, you know, week one, they played Jimmy Garoppolo and the Niners. And they win by 8 points. They were pretty good in that game, I thought. Week two, again, they're at Lambeau. They come back late, earn a tie. Nothing wrong with that. The Rams game, again, losing in Los Angeles, nothing wrong with that either. You maybe say, okay, well, they had one stinker in these four games against the Bills, and that was a game where, you know, they multiple fumbles went against them early. They played sloppy football, missed a lot of tackles. You could say, okay, maybe it's just a, you know, one bad game. Maybe it's a trap game, if you believe that's a thing. But at the same time, they're now 1-2-1. They're at Philadelphia this week, and the Eagles have their own flaws. They're not as good of a team, it looks like, as they were a year ago, but you would figure they're going to be underdogs in that game. Well, suddenly now they're 1-3-1, and the schedule does get easier after that point. They're hosting Arizona. They're at the Jets, hosting the Saints and Lions, who are two good teams, or two at least, you know, possibly good teams, but you'd figure they're going to win a chunk of those games. But after the bye, suddenly that schedule looks awful scary. It's at the Bears, hosting the Packers, at the Patriots, at the Seahawks, who, even if the Seahawks are a limited team, like, it's still at Seattle. That's still a tough game to pull out for anyone. So, I mean, you know, is it a thing where even if maybe we're underestimating or overestimating how much they're struggling and it's just a tough schedule, I mean, this is just the reality that they're going to be playing a tough schedule for most of this season?
Yeah, yeah. And just the way you describe it, in my head, I'm thinking if they're 500-ish at the midpoint, that's pretty good for them, given the start. And then they launch into that schedule that you talk about in the second half. And that, and then you start saying, well, you know, if this team's in the wild card hunt at the end of the year, then that's maybe an accomplishment. You know, given the start they've had and the level of difficulty of that schedule, and so you all of a sudden you start recalibrating what the expectations of them are, just based on a few weeks worth of play, and that's just kind of how this league is. I mean, a lot of things could change. Right now we think the Bears are pretty good. They could get found out pretty quick, and all of a sudden they're back to being the Bears, and maybe those games don't look quite as difficult. But right now, there aren't a lot of easy ones on their schedule, and they're really going to have to earn it if they're going to make the playoffs this year.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing you cover for us at ESPN, you're the rules and refereeing expert. You're the person who covers that element of the game at a really high level, and obviously have to ask you about the roughing the passer call, which after week three, after the Clay Matthews fiasco, the 3 weeks of Clay Matthews hits, it obviously seemed like it was perhaps the biggest concern surrounding the NFL so far this year. In week four, we saw the Arden Key penalty, which was not, I have to ask you about that one as well. But I mean, do you think this is a genuine problem for the NFL that they have to fix immediately before we get to next offseason? Or do you think it's a concern that maybe they can just sort of like with the Troy Vincent quote from earlier this week, that they can sort of, you know, work on during the season, then maybe address further in the offseason and just be fine with that?
I think there was, you know, I think there was a lot of significance in the statement he put out. Mm-hmm. The NFL is probably never going to change a rule in the middle of the year, unless it's just an unbelievably crippling issue. The CFL does that every now and then. It's kind of fun because it gets everybody up in arms that half the season is played under one set of rules and half the season is played under another. But the NFL would never go to that level, and I think probably for good reason. But absent of that, I think that the underlying understanding from the clarification they made is that, in essence, the controversial calls that have been made need to stop being made. Mm-hmm. And that whatever it was that the competition committee wanted to accomplish by making the roughing the passer penalty a point of emphasis was being taken and misinterpreted and being taken way too far by the officiating department. And that's a story in itself, because that's the second time that's happened this year in the relation to either a point of emphasis or a new rule, because they also had to issue a clarification on the use of helmet rule, which has now all but disappeared from our consciousness, which is where I think that the NFL wants it. So I think that last Thursday's clarification was designed to do what you were referring to without actually changing the wording of the rule. I doubt we'll change the wording of the rule. They want the Anthony Barr type hits on Aaron Rodgers called. They don't want the Clay Matthews on Alex Smith type of hits called. And I think most people can look at those two plays and see the clear differences. Driving the guy into the ground without doing anything to stop yourself, and the other one is falling on top of him after you hit him. They want you to be penalized if you're driving a guy into the ground. in any way unnecessarily, but if you hit a guy square up on the chest and it's core to core and you fall on top of him, that shouldn't be a penalty. It may take a few weeks to get that straight, but there was five through last night's game. Average had been 11 the first 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So maybe the message got through. We'll see what happens tonight when we finish up week four. But I think that was the hopefully for all involved, I think that's going to be that clarification is going to be what puts a stop to it.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain the Arden Key penalty from yesterday?
I can only assume, and you know, there was the one angle I think maybe Rich Eisen put out on Twitter that was it's Baker Mayfield's back. Mm-hmm. Where it looks like he just taps him. I think the view that was shown from the other side is that he did go helmet to helmet with him.
Okay.
It wasn't the most violent helmet to helmet. It wasn't quite Jack Tatum coming across the middle helmet to helmet, but mm-hmm. I think, and the referee is on the other side, so he sees basically he's looking at the camera, and so he's seeing the opposite view of what we saw on Twitter. And so, again, probably not the most violent helmet-to-helmet, but I think if the NFL is ever forced to explain itself on that, that's what they would say, is that he did hit him in the helmet, and anything close to that, and especially after he gets rid of the ball, is certainly unnecessary and is probably going to get you a penalty.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. We talked about this a little bit on Twitter. I know you talked about it, and I just agreed with you, but I want to hear what you think about it. So we were watching the Sunday Night Football game, and Mike Tomlin attempted to challenge something, and the referee in the game accidentally left on his microphone as he discussed the challenge possibility with Mike Tomlin and discussed what was happening with the play and brought in his fellow officials to discuss the options, and ended up not being challenged. But you tweeted, why isn't this always the case? And it makes total sense to me. That the referee's microphone should be on. So why isn't it?
Well, it's way too transparent for the NFL, right? I mean, the reason I immediately thought that is because I felt like we knew something more than what we would have known. Something, usually you watch guys talk and you have to try to read lips, or you have to try to figure out what the conversation's about or why something happens. And the NFL has always been in a position, and probably not unlike a lot of leagues, where they want the officiating calls to stand on their own. They don't want to be in the business of trying to provide explanations or context the next day. I guess they view it as a slippery slope, and people can read the rule book for themselves. And, in the old days, we used to ask for explanations, and they would literally send us the rule book back in an email. And so that was really the best that we could ever hope for. And so you crave any transparency and beyond what your reasonable guess can be of what they're talking about. And so that, it would be awesome to know how they come to these decisions, but what the coach is actually objecting to and why. And you would also see, in this case, they helped them out. If they wanted to be jerks, they could say, you threw the flag out, you have to challenge it. You can't, you can't pick it up now. And he would have lost a challenge that he probably had no chance to get. And so, and it showed a magnanimous side, and it showed that the officials aren't always out to get the teams. I thought it actually was an example of good officiating and good sportsmanship and all the above. And so, to me, that would be helpful for the league, but I'm sure they would be concerned about what else is said that isn't very nice and isn't very sportsmanlike, and sometimes is overly confrontational and probably profane. And I think there was a Bill Belichick meme making the rounds yesterday about a Dolphins player faking an injury and what he said to the side judge over there that probably wouldn't be great for family viewing. But it would, to me, and just like anything, the more information, the better, the more transparency, the better. And even if it was with a 7-second delay, it would be great to know what the officials are talking about amongst themselves and also with the coaches.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary, realistic to ask for totally unfettered live access to every possible microphone within an NFL game, but it does seem like there's a middle ground between that and total silence, and it really did. It added a lot to my viewing of that discussion, and I think it may bring in some more criticism for coaches here or there, but, I mean, it's the NFL. I mean, we're gonna draw conclusions without that information. I'd rather criticize a coach for the actual thing he was thinking than criticize a coach for something he wasn't thinking in terms of thinking about a problem or thinking about a game situation.
Absolutely. The less guessing, the better.
Less guessing, better. Why can't that just be the NFL's motto for 2018? It just seems like a really simple way to put it. Mr. Seifert, of course, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Where can people check out more of your work at ESPN?
ESPN.com/NFL, but also I put it out on Twitter at @SeifertESPN.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of The Bill Barnwell Show. We got more coming later on this week. Another show coming on Thursday. We might talk about some of these surprise teams in the NFL. But thanks to Nina Kimes. Thanks to Kevin Seifert. And more audio on the way.